Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Cynthia McKinney. If we can connect with her. We had a problem last Sunday, unable to connect with Michael Perrenny, and I was very concerned whether he was okay, because last Sunday there was a significant earthquake north of where he lives in the Bay Area in San Francisco. He lives over in the Berkeley area, and I think about 50, 60 miles north in Napa Valley, there was a 6.0 earthquake that I haven't followed all the detail following the quake, but it seems to me I've heard something about billions of dollars in damage being caused. And I was very worried when I didn't connect with Michael that maybe that earthquake had an effect down where he lived and that he was personally affected by it. It wasn't the case, and I will get Michael rescheduled. If I don't connect with Cynthia, I'll try to get her rescheduled. And I always prefer a guest in a pinch, like Sunday. And today, if I don't connect with Cynthia, I will go solo. There is certainly no shortage of things that I can talk about. I'm putting out daily articles again, thank heavens. And back to my two-article-a-day regimen, a couple of days I can even do a little bit more than that. So let me just start in talking about the big things that I see going on. And I try very – I can't write about everything, but I try covering as much as I can. And certainly the big things that have been going on in recent days have been Israel's genocidal war against the people of Gaza on the pretext of Hamas rockets, where the war has absolutely nothing to do with Hamas rockets. I can talk about that. Obama's waging America's third Iraq war since January 1991. Heaven help the Iraqi people over the last 30 years, along with the Afghans. I can't imagine people in any country suffering more than they have. Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, go back at least to the 1980s, the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. Afghanistan seemed to have been at war forever, way before the 1980s. The Afghans are probably the longest-suffering people I know anywhere, at least in modern times. There are certainly others that have suffered greatly. When things are happening in Haiti, I write about the conditions there. And going back over hundreds of years, I can't imagine any people suffering more than the Haitians. It extends over a period of maybe 500 years. Including when the Haitians who are there today were imported as slaves, and the original Haitians were not black people, and the Spaniards who came over wiped them out literally almost to the last man, woman, and child, and the slaves were brought over replacing them, and these became today's Haitians. Terrible, terrible story. It's been a good while since I've written about Haiti, because there are so many other things going on, and unfortunately there's only one of me. I wish I could write half a dozen articles a day to cover a lot more. Two is a great deal, but I'm back doing it without strain, so I'm very delighted to be able to do that. But we've got the Gaza story. We've got the Iraq story again. We've got the Ukraine story that goes on and on and on. I put out an article this morning I'll talk about. We've got the Syria story. And this is big stuff, because as I've mentioned on other programs and discussed with other guests, the ultimate aim is not so much the country. Well, it's certainly replacing the governments of the countries attacked and installing in their stead pro-Western leaders, pro-Western governments. But the real key in the region, which I would define as Eurasia, is isolating Russia, marginalizing it, containing Russia, co-opting Russia, and replacing its sovereign independent government with a pro-Western one, which America had in the 1990s when Boris Yeltsin was the president, this outrageous guy who was drunk half the time and spent more time drinking and at his dacha, God knows where that was, outside of Moscow, than he did governing. But he was a wretched leader. And he was gone. Vladimir Putin thankfully replaced him. And Vladimir Putin, geopolitically, is a very, very important guy. He believes in important things like the inviolability of national sovereignty, in the rule of law, in the notion that no country can attack another except in self-defense. He and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have worked endlessly, tirelessly, promoting peace in Ukraine. They absolutely say, and I believe it, that there is no military solution to what's going on now. It's amazing the freedom fighters that the U.S. media, the scoundrel media, and the U.S. government and Western governments, the people they call pro-Russian separatist terrorists and other derogatory terms, these people are very courageous. It's amazing what they're doing. They're literally taking on the Ukrainian military, which certainly is very well armed. And the only weakness of the Ukrainian military is that the conscripts don't want to be there. They would rather be home. They want nothing to do with fighting a war, period, let alone against their own people, which they're forced to do. They're notoriously underpaid. They're poorly fed, poorly clothed, and abominably treated. That doesn't exactly make for a military with the morale to go out and risk their lives, especially for something they don't want to do. So a lot of them cross the border to Russia defecting. Some of them join the freedom fighting militias. Some of them just go AWOL. And most of them simply don't fight with their heart in it. So it's very easy it is easier when you have a committed fighting force like the self-defense forces in southeastern Ukraine that I call freedom fighting Democrats, because that's exactly what they are. They reject the coup d'etat fascist government in Kiev. They want nothing to do with it. They want local autonomy. They want real democracy, and they deserve it, and they deserve our universal support. In any war, civilians are the ones who suffer most, and it's certainly true in Ukraine. I don't think anybody knows the exact number of civilians killed. I see numbers thrown around like 2,000 or maybe 21, 22, 2,300, maybe 4, 5, 6,000 injured. But I see photos of buildings blown up, residential neighborhoods, buildings where people live, blown up. Missiles and bombs target them. Attack helicopters go after them. So anything that moves on the street can be attacked and shot, or bombed, or strafed, whatever. And this is what's going on in Ukraine. And at the same time, these freedom fighters, especially in recent days, have made some remarkable gains. And that is what I believe prompted a story that broke yesterday. And the New York Times got caught with egg on its face. Let me pull up what the New York Times had to say. Well, here's an article. Well, I wrote an article this morning. I titled, it's already out, it's on my blog site, it's top featured on my blog. It's called, "The Russians Are Coming, Big Lies." Well, the Russians are not coming. The only thing the Russians want to come for is to deliver humanitarian aid and to show up in face-to-face meetings with the Ukrainian leaders or the Western leaders to promote peace, not war. Well, there just was a summit in Minsk 24 hours before the headlines in the New York Times and in other major media in America and across Europe, London Guardian, Independent, the BBC covers it, of course, and, of course, all the major media in America. But the New York Times is my favorite punching bag. I like to pick on them for a simple reason. It's because they have the most global clout, and lots of what appears on their front page ends up in stories around the world. So the New York Times is very, very important. And I make a statement I repeat over and over again that, unfortunately, on the one hand, the New York Times really functions as a quasi-U.S. ministry of misinformation and propaganda, and all the news it claims fit to print isn't fit to read. The important news, the most important news, the most important stuff that people need to know, you can bet you the New York Times is going to lie through its teeth about it. Their correspondents, their op-ed contributors, their editors. A friend of mine years ago asked me why I didn't contribute to the New York Times. I think I've said this in this program at one time or other. I said the only way I could ever get a byline in the New York Times would be if there was a publication by that name on another planet. I know the New York Times people know me. I've written so much about them. I've just battered them up and down one side and the other. I know they know who I am. I'd write free for them. I'd write a weekly column for them, but I wouldn't take a dime if they let me do it on one provision. They couldn't change a word I said. They'd rather pay me to go along with it with that idea. I actually contacted the Wall Street Journal once and made them the same proposition. I'd write to them free of charge. Give me a weekly column. Don't have to pay me a dime. Well, needless to say, they didn't answer me. I honestly would do it. But again, my provision is they cannot edit out anything I say. They can write a commentary commenting on what I say, but they can't change anything I say. I'm happy to have somebody comment on what I say, but don't change what I say. Anyway, the chance of my appearing in these publications is absolutely zero. It never would happen. But the New York Times literally got caught with its egg on its face. I'm one of many people that's on its list to get their updates. They can come anytime, morning, afternoon, after the Daily Edition comes out. They put these out whenever there's something, a breaking news or whatever they want to call it. And let's see where this thing is. Oops, I went past it. Oh, I got to read you what the New York Times said. Yeah, here it is. The headline, yes, I got this yesterday afternoon. And the headline was, Ukraine, not verifiable facts proof, but Ukraine says Russian forces lead major new offensive in East. In the opening paragraph, I'll read the whole thing to you. It says, quote, tanks, artillery, and infantry have crossed from Russia into the unbreached part of eastern Ukraine in recent days, attacking Ukrainian forces and causing panic and wholesale retreat not only in this small border town, but also a wide section of territory in what Ukrainian and Western military officials describe on Wednesday as a stealth invasion, unquote. This morning, that story disappeared. A new one replaced it. And the headline read, Ukraine reports Russian invasion on a new front. And the so-called tanks, artillery, and infantry were replaced by five armored personnel carriers that maybe did cross the border. The real story is this. There are lots of sections of the Ukrainian-Russian border that are not properly demarcated or demarcated at all. And all the time, people or soldiers from Ukraine and from Russia unwittingly cross over to the other side. They don't do it deliberately. There simply is no sign that says entering Ukraine or entering Russia. So they want it unwittingly across the border. It's happened many times with Ukrainians entering Russia. Never is there an incident. The Russian authorities simply do nothing more than say, you know, you crossed that border, and they let them go back, case closed. Well, that's not the way the Ukrainians did it. They proliferate bald-faced lies, big lies. There have been three of them. There was one on Monday about a few Russian soldiers crossing over, again, innocently doing it unwittingly. I don't know how many, but a handful. And then there was a story that came out yesterday about 10 of them in the Times language in, quote, camouflaged, unquote, clothing. I don't know what the heck that means. I mean, you're wearing something, they call it camouflage. Well, again, an unwitting crossing of the border. Vladimir Putin was asked about this at the Minsk summit during a press conference after the summit ended. He said he had not seen an official report about it, but he explained it basically the way I just did, that this stuff happens all the time. It's no big deal. No, nobody does it because they want to cause any mischief, and Russia never makes a big deal out of any of this, but the Ukrainians, obviously, with a lot of motivation from Washington, mainly, and the West, is doing just the opposite, claiming a stealth invasion. And then the New York Times went on in its article to claim that the Ukrainian military, they've got thousands of troops in the southeast area. If five armored personnel carriers crossed over, so we're talking about a handful of Russian soldiers that were in them with whatever other weapons they might have had. Nothing about tanks or artillery, nothing about attack helicopters, nothing about the warplanes, none of that at all. Just five armored personnel carriers, the lowest level of armored military weaponry. I'm not even certain if they have high powered guns. I'm sure they have machine guns, but exactly what the weapons they have on them, I'm not clear on. But it's not the heavy firepower you would find on a tank. And Russian tanks can be very, very powerful. U.S. tanks, of course, can be also. I don't know what kind of tanks the Ukrainians have. They have tanks as well. But according to the New York Times, the Ukrainian military was retreating in panic. Can you believe they would write something like this? Well, thousands of Ukrainian troops did not retreat in panic if five Russian armored personnel carriers crossed the border. They would confront them in short order and certainly stop them and ask them what the heck they were doing, probably arrest the people on them, seize the vehicles. Well, I don't know exactly what happened, but if the Ukrainian forces retreated in panic, it had nothing to do with a few Russian soldiers unwittingly crossing the border. But the New York Times didn't explain that, of course. They stress a stealth invasion, and of course there's no stealth invasion at all. And the big lies just proliferated throughout their article, one big lie after another. And the rest of the U.S. media picked up the same story, proliferating the big lies ad nauseum, where the truth is exactly the opposite of what they're saying. And what they're risking is, you know, they're claiming Russia of invading Ukraine, and what they're doing is, with repetitions of incidents like this, is literally heading for a potential confrontation with Russia, which in plain English means war. It could be something that could be maybe stopped before it gets out of hand, or it could be something that really does get out of hand, and we're talking about a very serious situation. And that's what the people in Washington, with their stooges in Ukraine, America's newest colony, fascist, putschist, lawlessly installed, democratically elected government ousted, to put these xenophobic, lawless, putschist, anti-Semitic, fascist criminals in power. And the guy who's their president, Petro Poroshenko, he's an oligarch, billionaire crook. He's a former politician. He was in the Ukrainian parliament some years back. He's held various ministerial commissions. They call him the chocolate king. He's got a food company. Among other things, he makes, desserts. But the chocolate is, I guess it's just a catchy phrase they use with him. It's more accurate to call him, he has a food company. But he's also in the shipping business. He's in the media business. He's in a couple of other businesses. And he made his money the old-fashioned way. He stole it. And Ukraine has a history of massive, massive corruption. So they pick a good guy to be their president, a guy who fits the mold very, very well. In my article, I include a short section where, because of everything going on in the East that apparently is attracting the ire of growing numbers of Ukrainians in the West, there are protests that are taking place against him, calling for his resignation. Oh, my God, the guy's only been in office a short time. If there are protests against him now, I'll be watching this very closely. You're not going to see very much in the U.S. media about this, but I'll be following it. Any information I can pick up, I picked up some, and it's in my article today. Again, it's top featured on my blog, Steve Lenman blog. The Russians are coming big lies, and indeed they are big lies, and they just repeat over and over again. Well, if the Ukrainians in the West turn against the government they should turn against, because it is a government working against their interests, then the situation will get very, very interesting. And that's exactly what I hope will happen, and I think there's a good possibility that it will happen. I just never dreamed that possibly it could happen this soon. But one more big thing is happening there, too. It was in another article I wrote that the Maidan protesters, Independence Square protesters, never left the square after the February coup that ousted the democratically elected president Viktor Yanukovych. I'm certain listeners remember the commotion, the violence, everything else that erupted last November. It happened, and the coup was on the 22nd of February. I remember writing about it on the day it happened. Yanukovych was out. Washington staged the coup. Victoria Nuland, one of the undersecretaries of state or assistant secretaries of state, she was the point person in charge of this. The putschists were installed in power. It was a ghastly situation. The Ukrainian police showed extraordinary restraint. The first day when things got violent, they did not. They were taken to task by Yanukovych, and thereafter they showed extraordinary restraint, even though there were snipers from the putschists on rooftops and from windows in nearby buildings shooting ordinary people and killing them and shooting police and killing them, and they still showed ordinary restraint. But you never got that explanation in the scoundrel media, the Western media. They were the bad guys. Yanukovych was the bad guys. Neo-Nazi-infested fascists, no exaggeration, the Svoboda Party, the right sector, it was obvious that these people were neo-Nazis. They made no effort to hide it. They came out publicly displaying iron crosses, swastikas, making Zikhail salutes. They didn't hide what they are, and they're still there, and they're still involved in the government, and they still have lots of power, and they're still involved in the conflict in the East. And I don't know what else they're doing, but these are the kind of people I call Obama's new friends. These are the kind of people Obama installed in power. These are the kind of people murdering people in the Southeast, and the Badan protesters are still there. The violence, I believe, is pretty much gone, except maybe an occasional Molotov cocktail. Nobody's shooting anybody. I haven't seen anything about that. I think there are a lot of angry people in Independence Square because they have not seen the promises that the Putschist government made become fulfilled. And they want the promises fulfilled. So they are doing things like burning tires, setting up camps the way they did it last year and early this year before the coup. They are doing those things. They're ignoring the authorities in Kiev, telling them to dismantle their barricades and so on. The last I heard, they're still there, which was not too many days ago. My God, they've been there since last November. They stayed all winter. It should be easy now in the summertime. So these people have to be watched very closely. Now with protests against Poroshenko, I can only hope that they grow and people realize how badly they've been had, that they've got a bunch of neo-Nazi thugs running their country, neoliberal neo-Nazi thugs running the country that absolutely want to do nothing for them and do everything for what I call the moneyed interests. That's what it's all about. The big Western corporations that want to come in and rape the country, exploit its resources, exploit its people. Ukraine is a mess on top of it all. The GDP by the end of this year may drop as much as 15%. The currency is getting absolutely battered. It's down about 60%. And the lower the currency is priced, the more expensive it is to buy imports, the more expensive it is for Ukrainians to buy the essentials they need. If they lose 60% of their currency, and the Ukrainians are already impoverished, and if they lose over half the value of their currency, I don't know how they could survive. We have the sparks that revolutions are made of. The Yanukovych government was very corrupt. It didn't deserve to be the government of Ukraine, but it was democratically elected, and the Ukrainians alone should have the right to either accept them or reject them, and no outside force, according to international law, and in America, according to constitutional law, has any right to interfere in the internal affairs of another country for any reason except self-defense. And the Security Council always has the last say. Again, you never see this discussed in the U.S. media. Never get a word of this in the U.S. media. It's always the bad guys are the good guys and the good guys are the bad guys. In other words, truth gets turned on its head. So the war rages in the Southeast. There are protests in Kiev, the capital. And I follow this on a daily basis. And anything that I think is important, I'll write about it. There's so much in my book. The trouble with a book is you have a cutoff date and you can have something extremely important happen. And if it's past the cutoff date, it's probably not going to get in the book. Well, that actually happened with me and my editor extended the deadline 24 hours so I could expand something in great detail. This was back when there was the massacre in Odessa, back in May. I forget the exact date, but the massacre in Odessa. And the true story was polar opposite of the story that proliferated in the media. So I took a chapter and I expanded and explained the real story of the Odessa chapter. So we held the presses for 24 hours. That was easy. But if it happened a week later, it would have been too late. But there's been so much that's gone on since then. The cutoff date was in May, and the book was published at the end of May. So now we're almost up to the 1st of September on Monday with all this important stuff going on. It's not in the book because it's too late, which is the beauty of writing articles, because you can always get out another article, and sometimes I can get them out the same day. Oftentimes I'll write an article and get it out the next day, but many times I can write it and get it out the same day, which is what I've been doing lately, getting it out the same day so people know about it. And then if there's follow-up information, get out another article. Before I went to work on the Ukraine book, I literally was writing two Ukraine articles on a daily basis, week after week after week after week, and I know I wrote hundreds of Ukrainian articles. A lot of it was just a daily recounting of the events that were going on. The book concentrated on the major issues and why they were important, like containing Russia and the vicious propaganda and where it comes from and why it proliferates. Just vital, vital issues. The geopolitical things that people need to know about, not so much the daily events, but you throw in some of the daily events to explain the major geopolitical issues. And there was so much leading up to the coup and after the coup for a good many weeks that there was plenty of material to write about. I could have written 3 articles a day. It's not a good idea to write an article that gets so long that you're going to lose your readers after they read so much of it. And my articles at times can get a little bit on the long side. But I felt more comfortable writing an article and ending it at a certain point and then picking it up by getting into a wholly different topic with a second article so people could see a headline and read as much as they wanted to of each article and at least get as much good information as they could, rather than put it all into one long article. A book is a little bit different. You can have very long chapters, and there are a few that are very long in a book. But when people read a book, they read so much, they can put it down, they can do something else, they can go back and then continue reading the book again. So a book is a lot different, and it has a different purpose than articles, which to a large extent cover the daily things that are going on, but also putting them in the context of why they're important, which is what I try to do in my articles. Just to recount what's happening, people are being murdered in Kiev or in Donetsk or Lugansk. I mean, it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to explain why this is going on, who benefits, who loses, and so on. And I certainly try to do that in my articles. Well, Russia is the ultimate target, and the real Ukraine story is using Ukraine as a pretext to target Russia. Russia and China, I call the final frontier. They are the ultimate countries that America wants to eliminate in terms of their independent sovereign governments. It's one thing to knock out Iraq. It's one thing to knock out Afghanistan and replace them with stooge governments. It's an entirely different thing to take on countries like China and Russia. And China and Russia are unified economically. Increasingly, a major gas deal was signed back in May, I believe. I wrote about it in detail. Huge deal. Nobody really knows how many tens of billions of dollars it might amount to, but it'll run for 30 years. My goodness, it could run for 60 years. It's an extraordinary thing. It shows Russia is turning more east than west, so the West can impose sanctions on Russia. They could end up imposing sanctions on China as well, and China knows it full well for dubious reasons, for unjustifiable reasons, which is the case with Russia, absolutely. It's Russia bashing. It's Russia bashing just to beat up on them and to make them public enemy number one and Putin public enemy number one. And this goes on and on and on endlessly. And it began before the Ukraine war began. It began because of Putin's backbone. That's why it began. It didn't happen during the Yeltsin years. But because of Putin's backbone, that's the reason for all this stuff going on, that he believes he will not sacrifice Russia's sovereignty to kowtow to America. And at the same time, he doesn't believe that one nation has the right to rule the world. He believes in multi-world polarity. Russia is a big boy. China is a big boy. There are other countries that are very important. We've got the BRICS countries, China, Russia. You've got Brazil. You've got South Africa. You've got what's the other one? Forget the other country. BRICS, B-R, Russia, B-R, I is, what is it? Iran, not Iran, well, China is the C, and South Africa, five countries that have the backbone to assert their own sovereign independence, and they're very much united, but the China-Russia alliance is extremely important. I is for India. How could I forget a country with over a billion people? I is for India, another major, major country. And these countries certainly want to be allied and do business with the West, but they also want to maintain their sovereign independence. I mean, they simply can't imagine giving it up, and they won't give it up. But China and Russia are the final frontiers. Russia is the only country in the world that can challenge America blow for blow militarily, the same kind of nuclear power, the same kind of delivery systems that can hit targets with pinpoint accuracy anywhere. China is extremely important economically in a number of years, maybe half a dozen or so. It'll catch and pass America economically, which is driving Washington apoplectic, and its military is no slouch. It has nuclear weapons. It has long-range delivery systems. Not as many nuclear weapons, I don't think, as Russia, but it could knock out U.S. cities very easily if China is attacked. And the idea that America would even conceive of attacking countries like this is what I call madness. And yet there are people in Washington who literally want to do stuff like this, risk the notion of World War II, which really will be the war to end all wars if it happens. But the unity of Russia and China, crucial. But Russia is being targeted separately right now. Russia bashing is the notion of isolating Russia, containing it, and so on, co-opting it, marginalizing it, making Russia the bad guy, and literally trying to. I don't know what the scheme really is. I mean, other than a direct military confrontation with Russia, you're not going to incite the Russian people to get mad at the government and want to overthrow it. Putin's approval rating at home exceeds 80%. 80%. And it's mainly because of his stance against America. He's got the backbone to stand up against America imperialism. And that's why the Russian people love him. Because he won't let America boss Russia around and tell Russia what to do. He's got a lot of work to do domestically with the economy. The economy is not that terrific. It was better a few years ago. It's not that great now. And the Russian people need an awful lot of help. They never recover from the damage of the neoliberal 90s. There's still a neoliberal economy going on. And Putin could do a much better job at home. But geopolitically, on a global basis, he's a hero. He's a hero. He refuses to let America become a regional or a world hegemon. He doesn't want war at the same time. He absolutely believes that the major geopolitical problems can and should be solved peacefully. And he and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have gone all out and continue going all out for peaceful conflict resolution. And the notion that they should be accused of waging war, which is exactly what the New York Times did, and the State Department, with the spokeswoman Jen Psaki, couching her accusation by using the term a likely stealth invasion. And thankfully, one of the at a press conference yesterday, the Daily Briefing it's called, one of the reporters challenged her and asked her why she used the word likely if there's an invasion going on. And she ducked the question and just said she chose to phrase it that way. And there was another follow-up question to the extent that are you saying that Russian brigades and infantry battalions cross the border and so on and so forth? And her answer was to the effect, well, we have no more details about this. Well, there were no Russian brigades. There were no infantry battalions. There were no Russian hordes. The Russians weren't coming. The whole story was a bald-faced lie. But yet it made headlines, and of course the New York Times got caught with egg on its face by having to pull the original story that they sent out to all their people like me, and thankfully I saved it. I'll save it in perpetuity. It'll be on my blog as long as I have a blog, and anybody can read it in my top featured article today. Verbatim, I quoted them. I'm sure they're very embarrassed about that, embarrassed enough to have pulled it, and the State Department should be embarrassed as well. They couldn't say there were hordes of Russian forces coming across the border because they don't exist. Where are they? And in today's sophisticated world, you've got satellites that can home in anywhere, and they can see exactly what's going on, and they can come down. I mean, they can look at your eyeballs and tell you what color they are. They'd know exactly if there were Russian forces crossing the border, roughly in what kind of numbers. They can estimate the numbers by, you know, so many per square yards or whatever. However they do it, they could estimate that very, very easily. If they had those kind of satellite images, they would have shown them. I mean, they can fake them. They have faked them. They faked them. They used old images a few months back that were made of Russian troops conducting maneuvers so many miles inside the Ukrainian, away from the Ukrainian border, inside Russia. And the report came out sometime maybe in April or May, and the footage, the satellite images they used were from August the previous year. So they can fake the images very easily, but they didn't even do that this time. There are no satellite images showing any Russians coming over the border, and if they can show hordes, they can show 10, they can show any number. The Ukrainians apparently made some videos with some comments by some of these people. I don't know who these people are. I don't know whether what they said they believe. I don't know what happened to these people to either make them say what they said. It really didn't amount to a hill of beans what they said. But they didn't say what I wish they had said. You know, we didn't say any border demarcations, and we came across and they told us we did that, and we apologized, and they detained us. That's what they should have said. They probably scared the bejesus out of them and said, this is what we want you to say, and if you say it, we'll let you go home, and if you don't, we're going to put you in prison and torture you. With that kind of a threat, they would say what they were told to say. And then the headlines pick them up, and the bald-faced lies follow, and this is what happens over and over again. When you have an imperial power like in America, when you have a putschist coup d'etat government in Ukraine, like the people running that government, when you have Western governments marching in lockstep with Washington, when you have a scoundrel Western media that pick up the official lies and repeat them ad nauseum, when they turn truth on its head consistently, the only way to get real information and to know the truth is to listen to programs like this, other PRN programs, the rest of the alternative media, some better than others. Anybody can find out by just sampling a good bit of it. But for heaven's sake, if you pay any attention to any of the major media, most people do on television, which is worst of all, of course. When I was ill, that's all I had. CNN, MSNBC, Fox, I had nothing but that. I had the video on, and most of the time I had it on mute because I couldn't stand to listen to what they were saying. There was no PRN. There was no Russia Today. There was no Press TV. There was precious little truth. I must say, there was a little truth, more than you would expect in the Gaza war, and I'll get on that in a minute. It was astonishing because the Israeli crimes were so horrendous that at least CNN, which is the one I looked at the most, got on a couple of guests that actually told viewers what they needed to know. And the only problem is when they get somebody like that on, they give them 2 or 3 minutes and bingo, they're off. But those 2 or 3 minutes were the kind of stuff that you almost never see or hear broadcast in the major media. But there it was. And they even had the UN come on and accuse Israel of deliberately attacking a UN refuge with civilians in there thinking they had a safe haven. A UN representative interviewed on CNN made that statement. And how could they make it? Because shell fragments were evaluated, and they did not come from Hamas rockets. They came from Israeli shells, and it was proved, and there it was. But, of course, a story told once and not repeated is practically a story not told at all. And a story that gets repeated over and over again, you know, the big lie repeated again and again, that's the one that makes the headlines and that people remember. So the bad guy Israel becomes the good guy, and the good guy, all the people of Gaza, including Hamas, the war had nothing to do with Hamas rockets. I'll get on the Gaza story briefly. The Ukrainian war continues. In many respects, it's like the Gaza war, and America is very much on the wrong side. The casualties in both countries, the Gaza casualties were greater. The death toll in both countries about the same, 2,000 plus. Injuries in Ukraine, maybe 5,000, 6,000. Injuries in Gaza, about 11,000. Vast parts of Gaza in ruins. Billions of dollars in damage done. One of the things I mentioned in one of my articles was, and this came from the Israeli publication Haaretz, and in one of my articles I wrote about an Israeli historian absolutely pillaring the Israeli media, marching in lockstep with the war, it just practically devoid of any criticism of the war crimes that Israel was committing. And I devoted an article about that, to the things that he said. He was talking about Israeli fascism. And my article was titled, Fascism Grips Israel. It's on my blog site. And the Harari story, it was an exception to most of what they published supporting the Israeli campaign, was that Israel killed 89 entire Palestinian families in Gaza. 89 entire families. And these families are extended. It's not just a few children. It's the extended families, nephews, nieces. I remember during Cass Led, there was a family, and I forget the name, but they numbered, I believe, either in the high 20s or the low 30s with the extended members. And Israel murdered them all in cold blood, slaughtered them, the entire family murdered. Well, they've done it again 89 times with their so-called Operation Protective Edge. The real story of Protective Edge, again, has nothing to do with Hamas rockets. The pretext for launching it was three Israelis were killed, maybe by Palestinians, who knows. Knee-jerk, whenever something like this happens, this was in the West Bank, by the way, in the West Bank, and this happened in June. Knee-jerk, Israel blames Hamas. Without any evidence whatsoever, without knowing exactly what went on, it could have been Israelis killing Israelis. Americans kill Americans. Other Israelis kill Israelis. And, of course, Palestinians may kill Israelis, and Israelis for sure kill Palestinians. But with no evidence whatsoever, Israel blamed Hamas. And then on the 8th of July, its campaign, its Operation Protective Edge, began. Hamas responded to Israel's aggression, and this is what happens every single time. It wasn't Israel responding to Hamas rockets. It was Hamas responding to Israel's aggression. And let me throw in one thing before I forget about it, because I wrote an article about this. And I quoted possibly the world's expert on so-called missile defense, Theodore Postol, an MIT physicist. And I remember him years ago writing and explaining about the impossibility of a bullet hitting a bullet. Israel's Iron Dome. I wrote an article quoting him in great detail, explaining that Israel's Iron Dome is a fake. When Israelis saw explosions overhead, it wasn't the Iron Dome intercepting Hamas rockets. It was the Iron Dome missiles exploding in air, having missed the Hamas rockets. And Postol said this, there's a good chance the Iron Dome had zero success, but at most it had 5% success. In other words, 5% lucky hits, 95% failures. And he stressed it repeatedly in his analysis, the world's expert, that the Iron Dome system is a billion-dollar-plus fake. But you'd never know it from the Israeli press. You'd never know it from the U.S. press. And Hamas rockets, my God, they're little more than firecrackers. Well, I don't want to call them firecrackers. If you got hit with a Hamas rocket, it could either injure you badly or it could kill you. But they're nothing compared to the Israeli weapons. And if an Iron Dome missile, the way Postol explained it, hit the tail section of the rocket, not the warhead, which was fairly small, maybe 20 pounds or 30 pounds, would do some damage, but not a whole lot of damage. Enough to damage your home, enough to kill you if it landed at your feet. Certainly injure you greatly. But if it hit the tail end of it, which was the biggest target of the rocket, it would simply release the warhead, let it fall to the ground, and if it worked right, explode. But you didn't get any reports in the major media about exploding Hamas rockets on the ground. Well, for the truth, of course, was that the Iron Dome intersected virtually none of these rockets. So they had to come down somewhere. So, except for the ones that maybe didn't work, and I imagine there were a few faulty ones, they had to explode somewhere. You didn't see any reports about that. So, again, the whole story was a big lie. But the real story behind Israel's attack was to prevent Palestinian self-determination. It had nothing to do not only about Hamas rockets, but about Hamas. It had nothing to do with Hamas. It had everything to do with preventing Palestinian self-determination. In other words, being a country of their own with fixed borders, in charge of their own resources, in charge of their own land, so that Israel no longer could steal it, no longer could expand its settlements, no longer could steal Palestinian resources, no longer could exploit Palestinians, no longer could do everything it's doing now, no longer could prevent diaspora Palestinians from returning. That's the real story, a protective edge. There's one other story. To destroy Fatah, the ruling government in the West Bank, and Hamas unity, to set them off against each other. But the real story is to prevent what Palestinians want most, a nation of their own, universally recognized. Finally, after all these years, they have their dream come true. And of course, what they really want is equity, peace, and justice overall. And the war was conducted to turn Hamas into a bad guy, to lawlessly call them terrorists, along with the other legitimate resistance groups, and wage a war Israel claims is a just war, which is anything but a just war, and enlist the support of the world community and public opinion on their side. Well, they certainly blew it this time, didn't they? Because when CNN puts people on and talks about possible war crimes, not many of them, but a few, when the UN condemns Israel on CNN, when the horrific crimes committed against civilians, around 80% of the casualties in Gaza were civilians, over 500 children, a few hundred women, these are the people who suffered most. Of course, it's true in all wars. You can't hide these facts. You can try to hide them. You can hide some of them. It's like the old story. You can fool some of the people all the time, and some of the you can fool all of the people all the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And that's the Gaza story. Growing numbers of people worldwide were absolutely enraged about what Israel did. And I got many interviews on Gaza. I'm sure I'll get more. And several times I was asked, what harm did this do to Israel? That's a very important question. I can only say I hope that the harm will be permanent, that people will spread the truth about Israel to other people and explain the horrendous crimes of war and against humanity, genocidal crimes. I call it slow-motion genocide, which is exactly what it is. I hope the world will spread to realize we're talking about an imperial country that wants regional dominance, partnered with America, America supporting its killing machine, and murdering innocent people in cold blood, and it repeats over and over again. And after the ceasefire was declared a couple of days ago, I wrote an article I titled, Gaza Ceasefire, Hold the Cheers. There is no chance in the world we're going to see a permanent ceasefire. We saw the same thing happen after Cast Lead, 2009. Same thing happened after Pillar of Cloud, November 2012. Now we see the same happening in Gaza, Operation Protective Edge. And the so-called agreements, terms, that Israel claims it's willing to go along with are pretty much exactly the ones it agreed to at the Pillar of Cloud, and Israel violated them straight away. Well, I don't know when Israel is going to violate what they agreed to, and it wasn't very much so far. But Israel will violate them. I don't have any doubt in the world. Of course, there'll always be a pretext, and the victim will be blamed. You know, you say Hamas did this, so we responded. You don't expect to sit back and do nothing. Well, Hamas always observes the terms agreed to. After Pillar of Cloud, They didn't lift a finger to attack Israel in any way, despite repeated Israeli provocations. And finally, it got to be too much. And I forget the specific incident, but there was one that was really over the top, and they did respond, and they got blamed for the crimes that Israel commits. That's exactly what's going to happen this time. There'll probably be Israeli pinpricks, and then they'll get tougher and meaner and nastier, and then maybe there'll be something so big that Hamas simply cannot sit back and do nothing, and Israel will accuse Hamas of breaking the ceasefire. Well, on the very day that the ceasefire was declared, Israel arrested 12 Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine members, one of the resistance groups in Gaza, 12 of their members lawlessly. They disappeared them. Nobody knows where they are. They committed no crimes. On the same day and the day after, they rampaged through a number of Palestinian communities in East Jerusalem and Nablus and other Palestinian communities. Rampage through them. Not a word in the U.S. media about this. So Israel already is violating the terms of the agreement. It may not be Gaza, but rampaging through the West Bank, terrorizing the people, arresting them, shooting them with rubber bullets, attacking them with tear gas, concussion grenades, probably killing one or two of them. Well, this didn't just go on the day of the ceasefire and the day after. This goes on every day in the West Bank. And once in a while, I read an article explaining this. Literally, every week, without exception, Israel rampages through Palestinian communities in East Jerusalem, in the West Bank. It does it pre-dawn. It terrorizes families. It breaks in. It arrests members of the family. It ransacks the homes. It destroys property. It steals property. It arrests probably the husband. At times it arrests children, occasionally even as young as 10 years old. What in hell does a 10-year-old kid do to scare Israel? But yet Israel does stuff like this. And again, not a single report in the U.S. media. And this can go on half a dozen times a day, literally. 7, 8, 9, 10 times a day. Anybody can follow it on an important website. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, every week they have a recap of the crimes that Israel commits. Every week. And you can read their weekly recap. You will not find a single day that Israel does not go on the rampage, at least to some extent. And sometimes it is horrendous. It could be 80, 90 times a week. You would think that's a newsworthy story. You would think that the New York Times ought to feature it and explain to the readers exactly what's going on. Does the New York Times do it? Does it ever do it? Does CNN feature it? I've never seen it. And if either one of them ever does it and tells a story accurately, I'll write a story praising them. I'm just about out of time. I've got a couple of minutes left. There's so much more going on. Obama's fighting his third war against Iraq. He effectively declared war against Syria. Of course, he's fighting what he calls, they call themselves the Islamic State now, ISIL, ISIS. The Islamic State is what they call them, so call them IS. Fighting them in Iraq. It's got nothing to do with humanitarian intervention or democratic values. It's about controlling the oil, dominating the country, the same imperial aims. And now Obama is flying illegal surveillance flights over Syria without the permission of the government. And the real issue is to provide intelligence information to IS to help them in the war against Assad, to oust the government and put in a pro-Western stooge one. That's what the Obama scheme is all about. It's not about attacking IS in Syria. It's about helping IS, America's ally in Syria, its enemy in Iraq, to wage war on Assad, to oust it. We'll talk about it on a future program, but I'm just about out of time. This stuff will be on my blog. I wrote one article about Syria. I'm writing more about it. I'm explaining all of this. And anybody can follow it on my blog. I hope you will. And I put my email address on the bottom of every article. I love to get feedback. And whoever emails me, I answer them. I got to sign off. I'll be back on again Sunday. I haven't said this for a while. Absolutely make this program a regular habit.
Thank you.